That Great Business Show, Ireland's best business podcast.
Welcome to episode 154 of That Great Business Show, where we bring you more great tips, insights, and unique business opportunities on every episode, all perfectly packaged into our commute-friendly podcast, with thanks to Dundeal.ie. I'm Conal Mora and Fáilte Isteach. Two more great stories for you on this episode. If you're in the entertainment world, or like being entertained, this one is for you, because entertainment is back in a big way, and we will tell you how to use entertainment to sell your business. And regular listeners will know that we find the whole area of shipping and logistics just fascinating. So, just for you, we have found a chief supply chain officer here to tell you the best way to get your goods and services to market. And we are now official podcast partner with Aer Lingus Long Haul. They want you to head for Hartford, and that's in Connecticut, USA, the best place to set up your USA HQ. Contact us at thatgreatbusinessshow.com to find out more. All our tips and insights are brought to you thanks to Dundeal Motors, the place to look for your new or previously loved car, van or truck. Dundeal.ie.
Dundeal Motors is home to Ireland's largest range of new and premium used cars. That's why you'll find cars from Audi and BMW dealerships on Dundeal. Are you looking for a 7-seater to accommodate your growing family? Maybe you're after a luxury saloon to make a statement. We have the car for you. You'll also find Ireland's largest range of electric cars to help you make the switch. Visit Dundeal.ie today to start the search for your next car.
Travel to Connecticut, USA with Aer Lingus service to Bradley International Airport. With the daily flights from Dublin to Hartford, we make business travel to Connecticut easy. Save time with US pre-clearance, enjoy Aer Lingus award-winning flight service, and experience the convenience of Bradley International Airport, perfectly situated for your travel needs. Learn more and plan your next business trip at aerlingus.com.
Now, you are in business, so of course you're only reading that a long queue of ships has formed at the Panama Canal, raising fears of rising prices for grain and commodities. Dry weather has lowered the level of the lake that feeds the lock, and the Panama Canal Authority, which normally allows up to 40 ships a day through in the summer, has cut that number to 32. This is just one of the fascinating facts that keeps us awake at GBS HQ. Ever since Christine's came on the show a couple of times to explain how worldwide logistics work, listen back for more. Closer to home, Luke Hanlon is Chief Supply Chain Officer with Musgrave, and you know that Musgrave is big, but I bet you did not know that they are one of Europe's larger family-owned businesses with 146-year heritage, claiming to support more than 41,000 jobs. I'll say that again, 41,000 jobs across more than 1,000 stores, warehouses and offices in Ireland and Spain. So, how do you keep feeding that beast? Well, Luke Hanlon, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thank you, Conal. Great to be here with you and your listeners.
Well, feeding the beast, it's a big beast. I didn't know actually until I did a little bit of digging that it was that big. Everybody knows Musgrave because you are Musgrave, you are Supervalue, you are...
Yes, Centra. So we have two sides of the business really in Ireland. We've got our retail business and people recognise brands like Supervalue, Centra and Daybreak, as well as Mace in Northern Ireland. So we have about 1,000 stores distributed across every town, village, city, every community really in the country on that side of the business.
And I mentioned Spain.
And Spain. We have a retail and food service business in Spain also, under the brands of Dialpre and Dialsor.
Big, small?
A reasonably small business, but a business that's growing, and our intention is to grow it significantly more in the years ahead. And then back closer to home, we have a significant food service business in Ireland as well under the Marketplace brand, which we service through a set of cash and carries across the island, and also a delivered food service business to cafes, hotels, colleges, creches, pubs, Chinese takeaways, everything in between, thousands of customers on that end.
Once upon a time, you were in UCC and you did food science.
I did indeed.
And nowadays, your job is to make sure that the sandwiches are getting to the colleges, or that the Chinese takeaways are getting their chicken or whatever.
Fantastic. Yeah, absolutely.
So no connection.
I guess supply chain is a science, I would argue, of its own. Some of the thinking from a scientific background has certainly helped me in my career. Been in Moseley now for 20 years. But supply chain is a science all of its own, and it's got its own dynamics.
And talk to me about it. Talk to me about all the real hassles that you can have. Okay, we know that a truck is going to break down or you got a flat tire or something else, but I mentioned there, and I only just mentioned it in passing, about the Panama Canal. Should the Panama Canal have any bearing at all on what happens in Musgrave?
Everything is connected. We operate in a global free trade supply chain, really. It's important to say that in an Irish context, we source the vast majority of our goods on the island and locally through suppliers that operate in the same communities as our customers do across our brands. So the vast majority of our product is sourced locally. It's collected on our fleet and delivered back out by our fleet to our customers.
That's the ad. Well done.
But then there are products. So if I give you an example on the food service side of the business, coconut oil would be a very important product for many of our customers on that side of the business in particular. And we have to source that product further afield in the Far East. And there you are exposed to a longer supply chain, a more complex supply chain. But the beauty of supply chain, and I suppose the art of supply chain, is to ensure that we build a resilient supply to take account of the length and the risk in those supply chains to ensure we meet the needs of the customer.
If you're sitting in your office, are you based in Cork? You are.
I am indeed.
If you're sitting in your office in Cork, so what do you do? Say, take your coconut oil. Mm. How do you find out who's a good supplier? What happens to a coconut tree, but they probably blow down or they get some kind of rare disease? Are you, and that's only one item.
Yes.
How many items in total would you
Tens of thousands.
So, yes. Like, logistically, how do you keep an eye on all of those things? So
if I start at the customer end, because that drives then the demand back, right? Our customers are at the heart of their local communities. So if you're a takeaway, a pub, a five-star restaurant, a super value store, a daybreak store, whatever, right? You're at the heart of your local community and at the pulse of your consumer in that local community. So the combination of that knowledge, that understanding, that anticipation of demand, along with our supply chain competency in Musgrave and other competencies across how we source product, allows us to deliver the needs of the customers all the time.
But have you got a vast software, piece of software or something trying to second guess people?
It's a combination of good systems, excellent people, and a track record and a heritage of doing this well over many, many years. That is our secret sauce.
I get that. But how do you know how many pieces of chicken are going to be needed in, I don't know, Dublin 8? On a Tuesday.
Yes. There's a local element. So if I give you an example, and maybe this isn't Dublin 8, but maybe closer to Tralee, right?
A lovely place.
A lovely place. And in the last week, they've had the Rose of Tralee Festival.
Okay, right? That's a lovely example. Okay.
So all of the Musgrave customers, so we've got some big super value stores owned by Garvey's in that part of the country. We've got Central stores, Daybreak stores, and a host of food service customers. Those customers are able to anticipate based on previous sales history, what their requirement is, what the tourist trade is like at this time of year, what the weather is like.
You can do a lot of things, not the weather.
we can't control the weather, but we can predict it to some extent. And that feeds into a forecast, which we then take as a supply chain and work with our suppliers to ensure that we can deliver on it.
I've just had a brilliant idea. Why don't you go on to RTE as a sponsor of the weather forecast to talk to people about that they might need extra chicken because it's going to rain.
It's going to rain, or it's going to be sunny perhaps.
Whatever.
On the rare occasion.
Sorry, my mind is flipping all over the place.
Fine. So what that means is, going back to your question about, you know, a particular product, one of tens of thousands of products, we have a history and a knowledge of that product and the requirement for it. So we will build a stock of that product commensurate with the demand and the risk to supply, and ensure that, you know, for some products, it'll be 2 or 3 days worth of sales if it's a very fast moving product with a short supply chain. In other cases, we could hold 2 months of stock if it's a long supply chain with a higher risk. But we flex that up and down to ensure that regardless of the circumstance, the customer can get the product when they want it.
And then somebody goes on TV and says, don't eat chicken, and therefore you're stuck with a whole heap of chicken or something like that happens.
In our supply chain, you've got a fresh part of our supply chain, which we run at a very low stock level because it's fresh. And we want to ensure we provide the freshest of produce to our system. On the other side, we've got an ambient, which has a longer shelf life, and we tend to have stock there. You do get those shocks from time to time, but you've got to manage them. You know, you've got to manage them as they come.
Go on, tell us some of the big ones that shocked you.
I'll give you some good examples, please, actually, from the pandemic.
Okay.
Right. So if you remember, in the early stages of the pandemic, there were particular products at different stages.
Toilet paper
was one, right? Toilet paper was one. That happened very early, right? And it's funny how that came about, because that came about based on some social media footage of customers in an Australian supermarket fighting over rolls of toilet paper at the early stages of the pandemic.
So where that came from? Often wondered.
And it drove a spike in demand, which then normalised. A couple of months later, the product moved to flour and yeast because everybody was making sourdough bread.
Of course, right? Yeah.
And then a couple of months later, and maybe this is less applicable to you and I, but a couple of months later, hair dye was in massive shortage because people were treating their own hair at home.
Of course.
So all of these products go through their own cycle based on what's happening.
But that is, you are now looking in the rear view mirror.
Correct.
So if your job, and I'd say that there is a board that wants to whack your head sometime, is that you're trying to second guess the future.
Absolutely. But we're constantly
scanning. But how?
Because we're looking based on the connection that we have with our customers. If I go back to that piece, right?
But people's choices change.
They do, but the anticipation happens on the shop floor. So if I look at one of our super value retailers, they're so closely connected with their shoppers. They're on the floor talking to their shoppers every day. They can pick up sentiment, views around changing categories, what's important now, what wasn't important a week ago, and that feeds back into our system so that we can then line up the supply
Lovely.
Chain to it.
Lovely, you've lined this up for me, because I've often wondered. So we're down in Tralee, we're in Garvey's supermarket, and the manager there notices a big run in spinach.
Yes.
How is that fed back to you to get more spinach in?
So we run a 48-hour lead time. So that store manager will order, and it will order up in quantity in that case. We will amalgamate all of those orders from all of our stores, and we'll see an overall change in pattern.
So are you looking at a screen watching this?
Correct.
A spike in spinach?
Yes, yes. All of these orders come in electronically into us every day. We amalgamate them.
I can only imagine that your place must look like NASA or something. Like, have you got a bank of screens with everything
moving?
There is a
team. There is a specific replenishment team that look at this activity every day and then work with our suppliers to line up the supply.
And how up to date is that information? Is that 24/7? 24/7,
yeah. If a store orders a product on a Monday, they will get that product on a Wednesday morning. It's that rapid.
Because you have your own distribution, haven't you?
Correct. We've got a...
And are you in charge of that?
I am indeed. Yeah, yeah.
That, so that's another nightmare, isn't it?
I wouldn't call it a nightmare.
you wouldn't, but I know that you probably would. How many trucks or whatever you use?
Yeah,
what do you have?
We have 11 distribution centres, a team of 2,700 people that work across those sites, and 500 trucks on the road every day. And your people will recognise a SuperValu truck, a Centra truck, a Marketplace truck. And those vehicles are delivering about 1 million times a year to our customers, about 20,000 times a week. And on their outward leg, they're delivering to the customers. And on the return leg, they're collecting from suppliers. So that's how our supply chain works.
Which again is a nightmare, because they're dropping to Tralee, but they might have to pick up in Limerick or somewhere. Is that correct? Or
well, we route it. In that example, we would also have deliveries to Limerick as an example. So we route the backhaul to coincide with the delivery route.
The backhaul.
Yes.
I love this industry term. I will be using that forever in the day now. Now, I have learned about, is it UPS or one of those, is that they never take a right turn. Is that correct? Or a left turn. That they have managed in their software, that they always go around in circles. Have you done the same, or
not as simple as that for us? I have to say,
because you're going down Bohreens and everything else.
There's that, and there is also the fact that we work with independent entrepreneurs. So our customers are independent entrepreneurs. Each of them has their own delivery requirements in terms of times of day. So it could be sometimes that we have to crisscross or take a left turn instead of a right. But that's the nature of us meeting our customer need.
Ah, yeah, but the independent entrepreneurs, let's say they're making eggs or whatever, if you tell them, they don't tell you. You're Musgrave. Come on.
We work in partnership with our customers.
I know that.
Absolutely.
Luke, and really, come on, be honest.
Well, I've been in the business 20 years, and
they
can honestly
don't
say,
tell you. You tell them.
We arrive at decisions together in the best interest of getting product on the shelf.
In the best interest of Musgrave getting their stuff. Exactly. What should people do bigger, better, brighter to actually be more efficient in terms of delivery? It was the original question, if you like.
Yes.
Is there must be things that, stupid things that nice people and good meaning people do, but that they could do better in terms logistics and their own supply chain,
yes,
into the likes of a Musgrave store.
Yeah, so I would say there's a few areas for us. One is the area of resilience, and I'm going to come back to these in a second. So resilience is one. The rise of automation and technology is a second. The importance of people as a differentiator, and sometimes automation and people are pitched slightly against each other. I think there's an and there as opposed to an either or. And sustainability. I think those are the kind of key areas that we would see as being really important now and into the future for any supply chain, regardless of its size or shape or scale. when I talk about the area of resilience, I think the challenges of the last few years, be it the pandemic, Brexit, the cost inflation issues, labour shortages, all those challenges, I think what they've done is they've re-established your ability to meet your customer needs, regardless of the circumstances, as being the number one priority. So we would work with our suppliers and with our own supply chain a lot on driving that, driving service level, driving on time in full into our system so that we can then meet the needs of our customers. The rise of technology, I think that's been an ever-present in supply chain and operations. The type of technology changes, but the theme of technology has been ever-present.
Are you going robots?
What we're doing is we are just gone live in our largest distribution centre in Kilcock with some semi-automated and some automated processes that use shuttles.
Now, what's the difference between a shuttle and a robot?
I guess when people think about a robot, they picture maybe a humanoid form with arms moving around.
No,
the warehouse.
I have a lovely lady, Irish lady, who is making supermarket robots in Norway. Can't remember her name, but we had her in the podcast. You should listen back because she delivers. It takes away the guy, but your bananas are all delivered to the banana area.
Yes.
And goes back
yes.
and collects more bananas
yes.
and all that.
And that actually is a great description of it because what it does is we use automation and shuttles, robots, if you like, to take out the manual movement and the manual handling of product that would otherwise happen in a manual warehouse. So we've just gone live with that investment very recently, and it's doing exactly what we hoped it would.
Such as, is there a percentage gain that you want to share?
We would say in productivity terms, for the products that we're using in this system, it can be twice as efficient.
Whoa. That is pretty impressive.
And significantly higher in terms of accuracy as well, because you're taking out some of the manual steps in the process.
Yeah.
So that's here to stay. The other part is artificial intelligence. And it goes back to some of our earlier conversation, actually, when we're talking about being able to gauge the demand of products and using all the information and data that we have from many years back to predict what's going to happen next.
But that means you have had to feed that in. Have you done all of that?
We have all that. We have all that data kept. We have a data lake that keeps that information. And we're developing an AI-driven set of engines that would allow us to make those decisions in a more intelligent, more automated way. So that's on the area of automation and technology. Sustainability is simply huge. It's a core objective of us and the people that we work with. So I mentioned our fleet and the 500 trucks on the road earlier. We are making big changes in relation to the fuel that we use in that fleet.
What are you going to go with?
So we've started into using a product called hydro-treated vegetable oil, HVO. Which is a biofuel derived from food waste in the food industry.
We had Brian Donaldson of Maxell on talking about that.
Yeah, I heard that indeed. So we're going to use 1 million litres of that fuel this year, moving to 3 million in 25 and half of our fuel.
How many litres would you use in a year of anything?
We would be typically 10 or 11 million euros, or litres, sorry, of diesel.
So 10% you're going to go. Yeah.
And we by 2030, we expect to be at 50%.
Okay.
In addition to that, we backhaul. So the backhaul activity that we spoke about a while ago, that takes 15 million kilometres off Irish roads today. Solar panels, we've 10,000 solar panels installed across our warehouses, our cash and carries, our office buildings. And the other piece, I chair an energy transformation forum in Musgrave where we've looked at how we use electricity and use energy. And year on year, we've managed to reduce our usage of energy by between 10 and 12%.
Year on year?
Yes.
That's chunky.
It is an important from a carbon perspective, but also in the context of energy price.
And profit?
Yes, absolutely.
They must love you. But back to your lorries and your trucks and vans, electricity?
For the smaller end of the fleet, so we do have some van operations and we have moved to electric vehicles on that side. But for HGV traffic, electric vehicles, for the type of work that we do, just aren't at the level yet. They could come.
Yeah.
Hydrogen might get there sooner. Yeah. But either way, we think that's 5-7 years away. So that's why we've pushed down the road of biofuel.
As you heard when I was chatting to Brian Donaldson, he said that the very fast charging wouldn't come within his lifetime. Then the following day, I just saw an email and I sent it to him, and it's probably going to be in fact, it's happening now, that they've got it down to 12 minutes charging.
Yeah, which is incredible.
And that's only the start.
Yeah.
Now, don't get into the politics of this, but you are a 32-county organisation, and I keep looking at Northern Ireland, and logistically, it must be a fascination for you, because in my mind, and I use the word advisedly, El Dorado, they have everything there if they just did it correctly. You are the expert. I am the amateur here. Am I reading the situation there correctly, that if goods want to come through Northern Ireland, no matter which way, that it could be used very cleverly to the benefit of Northern Ireland.
Absolutely. And as we know, in the earlier forms of Brexit, Northern Ireland was in the best of both worlds from that perspective.
As they are now, though, is that correct, or is that how you're reading it?
Yeah, the difficulty is product that comes into Northern Ireland that is designated for travel onwards into the Republic. That's the challenge now, right? But that doesn't really impact our business. From our perspective, we tend to look at our network as being a one-island network. So we have a concentration of distribution centres in the greater Dublin area. We have a base in Cork, and we have a base in Belfast. So we actually have three distribution centres in the greater Belfast area. And we look at that as being one ecosystem of people, products, systems, warehouses, transport that works to serve all of our customers. And that's the way we see it going short, medium and long term.
So I want to go back into this thing here. It's a touchy area, I know. If manufacturers coming in or out, it must be brilliant for Northern Ireland. And if you've got a unit, as in Musgrave's got units up there, that you can, I don't know what the nice term is. In other words, there is something, I can't even remember. There's a nice term anyway, about using it so that everybody's happy.
And that's exactly what we do. So we don't tend to look at our depots in Northern Ireland in isolation for that market only. Equally, we don't look at our depots in the Republic of Ireland in isolation for the ROI market. Uh-huh. We look at it as being one integrated network. So this has been one of the challenges with Brexit. It has had a multitude of flavours and looks and feels at different stages, and it's still evolving. So we're constantly assessing what that looks like to make the best decisions. But by taking a full island view, you get that benefit.
And if you were looking at it from outside, which you are in a way, but you also know it from the inside, would the words El Dorado work for you? Does it? It just looks to me like they have it sitting in front of them and they should use, or I might say abuse, I don't care, so long as they're making business out of it.
I think as a market, that's certainly true.
That's what I feel.
Yeah, I don't have that concern from a Musgrave perspective.
No,
based on how we're set up.
Yeah,
absolutely, but I think as a market, I think there's something in your point.
I just wish that they'd actually see this and just stop mouthing on about it. Just get, like, they're brilliant at business up in Northern Ireland.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, that's Island of Ireland. What about next door? Any plans?
Well, we're currently actually in the process of just finishing acquisitions on some food service businesses over there. So, Ritter,
what's the thinking there? Is this just because it's a nice add-on?
Well, it's a very complementary piece to what we do in Ireland. So we have a very successful food service business here through our marketplace and Larousse Foods brands here. So we service everything from mid-market up to premium across those. And this is a logical next extension for us. The market is right beside us. We share the same language. And the competencies are similar in relation to what we do here and what they're looking to do there. So we're starting into that journey now, and I'm delighted to say that we've made two acquisitions in the last 3 or 4 months in that area.
And that is to be continued, I presume, is it?
Our ambition is to grow significantly there over time, yes.
And then they send you off to Spain. Unlucky. Oh, no, lucky you.
Yeah,
this is a whole area that I am fascinated by. I think it all started, as it did for Dunstores as well in the 1980s, am I right?
I believe that's the case, I believe that's the case, where we acquired a business in the Alicante region. And we still have that business today. Turnover is a little over 200 million euros.
Oh, chunky enough.
It is, and you know, it's actually, I was over there not that long ago. And
oh, poor you.
I know, it was difficult after leaving the rainy Cork airport one day. But it's a real representation of Musgrave in a different market. And it's got different cultural considerations and everything else, but it is Musgrave in a different market. And the team there have done a fantastic job over many years. And our ambition is to grow that business, and we're investing to make that happen.
And does Spain feed into this NASA HQ of yours about demand and or supply, or is it just two different markets?
It's two different markets. So where we work together is on areas of synergy or areas of shared experience or shared competency. But the market, the team locally in the market know their market, they know their customers. And they tend to run the business more or less independently.
And can you give me any insights into what sells differently in Ireland versus in Spain? I'm always fascinated by this. Any unusual things that we love and they just hate, or they hate and we love?
I guess there's a lot of similarities, really. I remember walking the warehouses and some of the stores there recently, and they're very similar. They're very similar. Obviously, food service is a big part of what happens in Spain, particularly driven by the tourist industry. So it probably over-indexes as a market on that side versus retail.
But they, you say that about that they're very similar, but if you walk into a Lidl here, and I'm sure you've done so, probably burnt the legs off your feet off you, and if you walk into a Lidl in Spain, there are very big differences. For example, in the drinks area, which I can never understand why all units are not just laid out the same, but they don't do the same in Spain, via Ireland.
Yeah, it's a different customer. So like many other organisations, Mosgrave, when it designs its propositions, regardless of what brand that proposition is true, will start with what does the customer want, right? And that changes over time. So we're currently revamping and reformatting some of the formats that we have in Spain, as we would in Ireland. But it's in the context of what does that shopper or what does that food service customer actually want from us, as opposed to what we want to give them. So that's the piece of work that happens there.
And back to Ireland, because you just suggested this to me, is the difference between the customers in each of the different types of stores. So who are they? Who goes into which ones?
I'll give you an example. I went on a route with one of our drivers recently, and it was actually out on the west side of Cork City.
You getting a lift home, were you?
And we covered 18 different drops on that morning. And the variety of customers that we delivered to was even astonishing for me, and I'm in the business 20 years. We did everything from Circle K to Subway. We did deliver to a creche.
Do you see you supply Circle K, do you?
We do the logistics for Circle K.
Okay.
And Subway and others. We delivered to a restaurant, a hotel, a cafe. We did all that on the one route. Each of those customers has a very different requirement of us, right?
Yeah.
And we have to understand that in a level of detail to maintain their custom.
And somewhere that has to be inputted into a computer, presumably.
Yeah. Well, it's
how many people work in the logistical, my NASA HQ area?
we would have planning teams of in and around 100, 120 people.
Inputting all the time, are they?
Inputting and working with suppliers and working with other functions in the business. But when you mention people, Conal, it's one thing I really want to get across is we talk about technology and we talk about systems and what's happening in the future and everything else, right? And I think that's important. But I think the differentiator really comes down to culture and people. And we have incredible people working in Mosgrave. When I think of a couple of stories, maybe to bring it life, we go back to Storm M and Storm Ophelia, which are distant memories for us now, 2017, 2018. Storm Ophelia was a very,
Which one was the big snow?
Emma was the snow, Ophelia was the high winds, and I remember both of them vividly. Ophelia with the strong winds, we had drivers that took their own personal chainsaws out in their trucks with them to ensure that if they needed to, they could clear roads to deliver to customers. Storm Emma, where we had heavy falls of snow, we had local farmers and tractors pulling our trucks into the local village to get to stores.
You remember the other one? Was it a Lidl or an Aldi store? Somebody took a JCB.
I do remember that too.
Come here to me. I bet you are hiring, are you?
Always, yeah.
Who are you looking for? What are you looking for? I mean, you've got a massive number of people working for you.
We do. We're 2,700 people from 50 different nationalities.
Wow. What a change.
And the breadth of skills are everything from planning roles, through to people working in our warehouses on days and nights, through to drivers. We actually run a driver academy now. The whole area of driver shortages is well publicised. So we run our own Mosgrave.
So if somebody wants to become a driver, they can buzz you and you'll teach them how to drive.
What we do is we work with existing employees in our warehouses who want to become drivers.
Okay.
And we support them in their learning and their journey from being a warehouse operative to being a driver.
Okay.
And that's working well for us.
Do you know that I saw a UPS driver in the States? I bet you have no idea how much he, she earns. Did you see it?
No.
$170,000.
Okay.
I had to actually go back and read it again.
Yeah.
And I saw their spouses saying that they're made work for $170,000, which I can understand. Now, my point about the hiring is, you came out of food science, as I mentioned, and you ended up doing what you're doing, which is running NASA. Final question, hire in a heartbeat. Who would Luke Hanlon hire in a heartbeat?
The person that comes to mind, I think it's a great question, by the way, the person that comes to mind when I think of that question is a lady called Caroline Currid.
I haven't heard of her, I don't think.
So Caroline is a sports psychologist and she has an credible track record in that she has been part of, is it 8 or 9 All-Ireland winning teams? She's currently the sports psychologist with the Limerick Hurlers, which is one of the reasons why I would seek to hire Caroline, so that she might slow their march down a small bit. But she's worked with the Tipperary Hurlers when they won, the Dublin Footballers, the Tyrone Footballers. So her whole mantra is around creating the right environment and the right climate for teams and individuals to deliver special outcomes. And in my view, that translates readily across the business. And I think having someone like Caroline as part of the team would help us move further in that direction.
Well done. Caroline, you're hired. I presume you'd love to have her on your team. You could also teach her how to drive a big truck and everything else. Fantastic. Luke Hanlon, Chief. Not an ordinary one, a Chief Supply Chain Officer with Musgrave. Thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thank you, Colin.
That Great Business Show.
De Facto, the revolutionary shaving oil, changing the face of shaving. For the smoothest shave of your life, just add water. No more lathering up or cleaning up afterward. Just add a few drops of water and you're ready to go. De Facto's blend of all natural oils hydrates and protects your skin. No more razor burns or irritation. A spa treatment for your face. Perfect for all skin types and lasts so much longer than traditional foams or gels. De Facto, a shaving revolution. Just add water. Available from selected pharmacies and from defactoshave.com.
Travel to Connecticut, USA with Aer Lingus service to Bradley International Airport. With the daily flights from Dublin to Hartford, we make business travel to Connecticut easy. Save time with US pre-clearance, enjoy Aer Lingus award-winning flight service, and experience the convenience of Bradley International Airport, perfectly situated for your travel needs. Learn more and plan your next business trip at aerlingus.com.
All That Great Business Show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
Though it is called the Cork Opera House, it's also home to every class of entertainment. And of course, COVID did put a stop to all of that, but they are back. In a post-COVID world, we all want to be entertained. But my friends in the front seats of show business tell me that money is too tight to mention and that high ticket prices just won't fly. So, what can Cork Opera House CEO Eileen Gleeson do to keep the show on the road? And how can your business use their business? Eileen Gleeson, welcome to That Great Business Show. And thank you so much for coming to us from the Second City.
Thank you. It's very, very lovely to be here.
So, where do we start? It must have been god-awful the day of COVID when you shut down. Because you shut down for how long?
Yeah, we were shut down for most of 2 years, yeah.
When you say that,
yeah,
it's frightening, isn't it? Yeah. It's like going to jail for 2 years or something.
Really scary, and I can't believe that it happened. I actually can't believe it. Now that we're back up again and we're back at the pace that we were at, in fact, moving even faster, I would say, it's unbelievable to me to think that that happened to us all.
And I said that we want to be entertained. Is this true? I mean, is it, do you smell, feel, touch? Can you see people like just mad clamouring?
Oh yes,
to come in to be entertained.
It took a while.
Okay,
you know.
Talk to me.
About this time last year, I was worried. I was wondering if it would come back. I would think there was maybe 60% of the audience back, but I was really worried.
Were they worried about coughs and sneezes, or
I think it was just everything. I think there was kind of a feeling of being paralyzed by being at home for 2 years. You know, people invested a lot in their couches and their comfortable clothing, and you know, their streaming on TV and their podcasts, and they came to know other ways of entertainment and other ways of meeting their needs.
Eileen Gleeson, there is only one way for entertainment, that is live entertainment. Everything else is kind of second best, including podcasts. I mean, I love live.
Yes, and I think people realized that. It took them a little while, but then once they started coming back, it then began to move very quickly. So by last Christmas, beginning of this year, we really saw the sales pumping in, and it's been going great since then. You know, I'm not, I think there is a legacy from what happened, but I think that we have taken the best from the situation and really incorporated it into our work and continued to be successful.
Explain, what are you talking about exactly?
So being closed for 2 years, I mean, I wasn't off for 2 years or anything like that. I mean, I had a core team that continued to operate and make sure that the building was looked after and that, you know, that the relationships with our stakeholders were maintained. And, you know, we had to like find emergency funding. We had to find several ways for us to survive. And that took up a lot of time.
I presume the government did look after you.
They did very well. And they were very kind and very, very supportive of our situation. And to be fair, were very arms around the entire industry, including the commercial industry, which I thought was really good to see. And was the first time that the two met, you know, the arts world and the funded world with the commercial operators also. So that was interesting to be part of that. And also it gave me a long time to think about the organization I wanted to run when we opened up.
That is a leading statement.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What are you going to do?
It really made me think about what we are for, who we belong to and why we exist. And
you are the centre of entertainment in our second city, Cork. So
we are.
Isn't that it? I mean, that you make people happy.
Yeah, we're the biggest outside of Dublin. We are the one of the only independent producing and receiving houses left in the country. And we,
what does that mean?
So we're not owned by Live Nation or MCD. We don't have, we're not a for profit. We're mission driven. So we're a registered charity, which means that we have a voluntary board and we are funded and we get to be cutting edge and we get to drive different genres of art forward. But we also are very commercial in our operation. We, you know, we have to make a lot of money. It's a big facility. It's a big house.
And I know you're not here to diss the opposition, but when people mention Live Nation, I always want people to understand there's nothing wrong with them as an organization, except they are huge and they do own and run and manage most, if not all, of the big acts, not just in Ireland, but around the world. And they are, well, they're not helpful to smaller operations like yours.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I find them actually quite helpful, because our operation wouldn't survive without being part of this big ecology and this big industry that's really vibrant and really, it's really important, like, that we understand what the industry in which we work. And Live Nation play big part of that, because they use us as a venue. They come and they rent the space, and we have access to their artists, and we take the seats out, and we have big parties and we have big gigs, and they create big huge moments in our venue, which we're really grateful for, and they're a customer of ours. And absolutely, it's complicated, and the trying to maintain independence in a world where we're one of the few independents is hard work, but a worthy cause.
What is selling? If somebody was listening and they said, I am going to go into the entertainment business and I could choose anything, singing, dancing, drama, whatever, what would you say, this is the one for you? This is where you can actually make some money.
So I would say never become an opera singer. That's the first thing. But I think when you're an opera singer, you can't help but become an opera singer. Like, that's the whole deal. It's a vocation.
What you don't know is I love opera.
Oh, you do?
I love opera. But anyway, that's a different thing altogether.
Different story.
Back to, so no opera singers.
I would say if you were a country music singer, that'd be a good way to start.
Garth Brooks.
Yeah, Panto. Panto's a great, great, great commercial production.
Oh,
and
come on, you set
success.
Yourself up. I have to ask you, there was going to be a Panto. There was a kind of a Panto that didn't work in Dublin. You know what I'm talking about.
I do.
Did that come as a bit of a surprise to you that it didn't work? No. Don't you have to kind of build up to these things?
It didn't come as a surprise to me, no, because when you're not, you know, when your core business is in show business, it's impossible to just make shows, you know, like it's really, really hard. Like, we make enormous shows in the Opera House that run for 8 to 10 weeks. We make them ourselves. We originate them. We do that work, and it's really, really hard. And we have, like, we depend on a lot of very, very specialized information and specialized individuals. And it takes a long time to make a show. It's never, ever going to be profitable until every single element of the show is right. And then after that, you have to convince your audience that it's worth it. And then they have to come in and they have to like it. And there are so many moments where it can all go wrong. And it does go wrong.
And it keeps you awake at night.
It keeps me awake at night.
Okay, no opera. Maybe put on the Stetson. What else should I be doing or thinking of doing? What is selling at the moment?
It's amazing. Live podcasts are going through a moment. They're having a moment.
It's going to be forever, of course.
But we're seeing more and more, like, we're seeing more and more podcasters do live shows.
And is that for entertainment, or is that like amusing? Because, you know, Joanne McNally, that type of thing.
Yeah.
That is pure comedy?
It's entertainment. It's often kind of comedy or sports based, and it's they have a lot of followers. They have a lot of big Instagram followers, and they do a lot of work in the background to make sure that they keep their audience engaged. And then it's about, you know, they're superstars. Some of these podcasters are superstars now.
What do you mean, some of? You're talking
Friends
to them.
Friends Company included. But like, even I was recently at a big podcast by two young Cork men who went to London and have a podcast called I'm Grandmam, and their whole podcast was based about them ringing their mams back in Cork and telling them they were grand. Even though they're in London, they're grand. And it's a beautiful podcast, and they did a podcast in Cork, and it was like, I could have sold it. I could have sold it 10 times over, you know, because they have amassed this enormous youth following. They're like young kids in their 20s, early 20s, which is an audience that we find really hard to access.
Ah, that is not lovely that you are actually accessing them. I'm old enough to remember that Thin Lizzy were used by the Peacock Theatre to try to bring people in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's, I mean, I even spoke to the boys about it afterwards that, like, you know, they're from Cork. Like, let's develop this relationship that you have with your home city, and let's talk about maybe going into more meaningful production, performing arts events and that kind of thing, you know. So, you know, it's a lovely, lovely thing when you begin to see how you can engage with an audience that you've been struggling to engage with, you know. And it's about being really open as a curator and really open as somebody who's responsible for making decisions about what people see. I cannot forget about young people, and it's really easy to forget because so much of what is out there is not tailored for them.
Why is it called the Cork Opera House and not the Cork Country and Western Panto Podcast House?
I think that there's been a Cork Opera House in Cork for 170 years coming up, and I think that it has always been culturally really important to Cork that there's an opera house in the city.
What's the name? But the name, when I heard Cork Opera House, I immediately thought, oh, that must be where they have the opera.
And we do have opera.
I do, of course.
Plenty of it.
But the real action is, because you've just told me, in anything else but opera.
Yeah, I mean, we probably, I would say that we produce maybe five operas a year. We make or we present five operas a year, which is a lot for any house, any independent house. And some of that is self-produced and some of that is our national opera company who are touring, and other bits and pieces that are around that we take on. But like, to be honest with you, I would say 80% of our programme is commercially focused and 20% is artistically led. And it's the 20% of our programme that's artistically led. That's our mission-driven work. That's the work that is developing the local artists, that's investing in our community, that's making us relevant, that's protecting our future, protecting our legacy as a house. And I think back, you know, 170 years ago, 150 years ago, it was opera. It was two-week runs. I remember it well. It was many, many weeks runs of opera. They used to sail up through the city and from the quays, get out of their ships and come in, load into the opera house and do their run at the opera house. And Cork has a really special relationship with opera as a result of that. Like, you can have a conversation with anybody on the street about opera in Cork and they'll be able to tell you their favourite area, or they'll be able to
get
tell
away.
You.
I never knew that.
It's a phenomenal thing.
And what huge names, I'm putting you on the spot now, can you remember any huge names that might have sailed up the Lee and came in and said, la, 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 la?
I mean, there have been many, many names down through the years. Can I think of one off the top of my head?
Maybe not, but you do also have the jazz festival. Do you do, during the jazz festival, do you do jazz?
We do jazz, but we do jazz in our little jazz bar that we have out the back of the Opera House called the Green Room. We have a full jazz program there where we bring in lots of jazz artists from Cork and from the city and from and other visiting artists who are in the city for the weekend. And we have real jazz. And then out the front, we have a
jazz.
Big party.
Real jazz. Yes. Now, that's interesting. You're not talking about Dixieland stuff, is that right?
Not necessarily, but I suppose I'm making the differentiation between the party that is out the front. We might have the Coronas, or we might have something that's completely not jazz. And we balance it then by making sure that we have some really high-end, like very sophisticated jazz performers.
For the likes of me, of course. What is the business model? Because you are a not-for-profit, you are subsidized, but you're also selling beer and popcorn.
Yeah.
Where is the money?
So obviously ticket revenue is a really important part of it. And we're
however, and I'm going to cut across you here, my man at the ticket box tells me that anything over 40 euro or thereabouts isn't or you can't really sell, correct or not?
Oh, I would say that's correct. Yeah.
What
unless
is that
it's
about?
A very special, like a Van Morrison or, you know, somebody who you know that they can demand. That's very rare though, you know.
But at 40 euro, do you see just sales go really quiet? And is that a function, or do you know, is it a function of a hidden recession or just tightness, money? Just
I mean, there's a couple of things. I think it depends on the artist, first and foremost. I mean, it depends on people's commitment to seeing this artist. Because if it's an artist that people really want to see, then there is no barrier. There is no financial barrier to that, really. There isn't, in my experience. If it's an artist that's on the way, emerging and on the way up and maybe not fully established yet, maybe doesn't have a big international career yet, that's where the 40 euros would make the difference. The difference between the 40 euros and the 30 euros. They might spend 30 euros on it, but they probably won't spend 40 euros on
it. And when they come into you and you say, they say 50 and you say, and not happening. Is that right? Or what was
yeah,
that?
Well, I
is
say,
that the conversation?
I say it depends on what the deal is, I guess. It depends on what the relationship is with the promoter. If it's self-produced, we'll decide our own ticket price. If it's a promoter bringing an artist, we'll recommend, you know, what we think will work. And generally promoters will go with our recommendations because we know our audience very well.
Where is that audience coming from?
Cork City and County mostly, but we also get people visiting from Kerry and from Waterford
so
and from Limerick.
South,
and
the wider south
yeah,
area.
Yeah, the wider south area, exactly.
How many seats? Not that huge number, is there?
It's just under 1,000 seats.
Okay, yeah. That's okay.
Yeah,
it looks smaller on your website, I can tell you.
It's a lot of seats
I
when you're trying to sell them.
Of course. So back to what sells. What else? Variety acts, anything unusual?
Variety acts. So comedy is a big seller for us. Okay. Like comedy is huge and it's really inexpensive to produce. So
you've got that brilliant guy.
We've got Kevin Bridges coming in and we've got a few.
But you've also got the fella from Cork. Fella who does, I see him on Twitter. He talks about, is it about North Cork?
Bernard Casey, is it?
I can't remember the guy. He's an advertising agency guy or... no. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But he's...
There's a lot of funny people in Cork.
There are. Yeah. So does local sell better or does international sell better or...
Interestingly, in all the places I've worked, in all the countries I've worked, I have never seen anything like the relationship that Cork Opera House has with its local artists and its local audiences. And I think that comes from this unbelievable sense of pride that exists in Cork. Now, I'm not from Cork, so I'm coming at it and seeing as an outsider this experiencing...
You're from down the road in Kerry.
I am from down the road in Kerry, which I'm reminded of on a daily basis while I'm in Cork.
And you said about the international experience that you have, we have to mention that you have been in the company of one Barack and Michelle Obama. How come?
I actually produced a gig at the White House in 2011.
As you do.
As you do, as part of St. Patrick's Day. I was there myself at the Kennedy Center as an international fellow. I was accepted as an international fellow. That was a fellowship that lasted a year, where you get to work with all of the top management at the Kennedy Center, which is this big, huge, 260 million euro a year budget, you know.
One of three non-Americans, correct?
That's correct. Absolutely, yeah. It is.
You see, and I did my homework.
You really did your homework. And as part of that, you know, I kind of set my sights on the White House, seeing as I was there, I might as well do it. And I knocked on many, many doors and it managed to pay off. I had my sights set on St. Patrick's Day. I knew there was an opportunity while I was there to challenge myself. And in fact, the fellowship kind of challenged me to do it because part of it was to like deliver something.
Wow.
And this is what I delivered.
And
yeah.
Did you leverage, as the American might say, the Kerry and or Cork connections, or how did you?
No, it was nothing to do with that. It was political, in that, you know, there was lots of Washington DC is a political place, and a lot of the people who work at the Kennedy Center have political allegiances and have connections in the White House. And you know, the Kennedy Center is the national cultural center. So I was able to work with the people there to try and broker this conversation about Ireland and the US and representing Irish arts in the US. And St. Patrick's Day is a really helpful moment for Ireland, the US, and we get a lot of exposure to the government in the US, more so than any other country, I would say, because of the celebration and the handing over of the shamrock. So I used that opportunity, and I used my I brokered this very carefully with my colleagues here in Dublin as well from Culture Ireland, who were, you know, helping the White House decide who was going to be.
And you got the gig.
We got the gig, yeah. Not personally.
But you did get it. You were
well,
there.
Well, I got it. And then we bought the guys over from Dublin. We bought our National Chamber Choir from Dublin. And
back to business, because we are a business podcast.
Yeah.
Even though you'd love to sing, because you do sing.
I do.
What could businesses, plural, use and abuse the Cork Opera House with? In other words, in terms of promoting business, what do you say, Jason, if only they did this? This is an opportunity that's going amiss. Here's another opportunity that people could use us for this.
Yeah. I mean, it's the association, I think, that is really strong that we have with our community. You know, the fact that we have 200,000 people in our house every year, the fact that we have, you know, consistent branding and marketing around the city all the time, that we're always, always selling. Every day we're signing tickets, we're selling, we're in multiple different ways. And I think the association that people have with the Opera House is a very positive one. It's one of nurturing, of comfort, of families, of good times, of entertainment, of like laughing, being with family, being with friends. It's very, very feel good. And I think that brands, you know, collaborations, brands, successful relationships that we've had with brands have been them seeing the possibilities with that and seeing the possibilities of the association with us, and also seeing the kind of heft of the organization. Like, we're big, we're loud, we're there, you can't miss us, we're bang in the middle of the city.
But you're not going to be called the OMO Cork Opera House or anything, are you?
I mean, probably not, because we have to retain a certain amount of independence. But like, we're open to all conversations and are having all conversations.
And one of those conversations must be about what could happen next, because I'm also told by my man in the ticket box or the ticket office is that there is this second venue about to open.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going into pre-building at the end of this year, and it's this new event centre that's planned for Cork, and it's for...
Can Cork carry two?
So it's conferencing and events and entertainments. So I guess it depends on what's the most profitable. You know, I'm thinking there'll probably be quite a few conferencing, because it's a city that really needs that facility. So this is a really positive development for the city in that regard. In terms of events, you know, I think that we will have the capacity to bring in the Beyoncés and the huge events that are coming to Dublin.
You can end the conversation here. Beyonce is coming, is she?
I hope
if,
so.
If I don't get tickets, it's all over.
I hope Beyonce is coming. It'll make it all worthwhile. And I think that, you know, it's about like, it's going to be challenging for the Opera House. There's no doubt about that. And I think the way it would be challenging is if, you know, we have a Dara O'Brien who'll come to us for a week and do a week run here in the Opera House. You know, it might just be like one night for him in the new venue. So it's like about making sure that the intimacy of Cork Opera House is protected, that the relationship with the artist is protected, that the artists feel that they continue to feel that connection with our audience in that intimate space.
You have 1,000 seats, which is intimate.
Yeah.
The second one, the new venue, is going to have how many?
I think it's 6,000 seats.
I think it will
vary between 1,000 and 6,000. So I think, I honestly can't say for sure, because I don't know the ins and outs of the plans, you know, but I know that it's going to happen. And I think that it's a positive development for the city, but it will be, you know, I spoke earlier about having to remain independent at a time where it's very difficult to be independent in this industry. And I think that we will have to work very hard to retain our identity in the context of our environment changing. But I think that we will do that very successfully. And I think that we, in all of our strategic planning and we have a new strategy launching now at the end of this year. And the thrust of that strategy is around bedding in as a producing house, keeping our identity strong, making sure that we are engaging with the community in a real way, and that we're inclusive, and that we are talking to everybody in our community. We've started working. We have a very highly tailored, like, interesting and exciting program now with autistic artists that we're working. We've created, you know, a moment for autistic families of autistic children to come to see our panto. And I think that's, when I go back and think about, you know, what I did during the 2-year closure, it was about actually really thinking about our responsibility as a nonprofit and about how we need to remain. And whilst it's not going to bring in lots of money for us, it's not really about that. It's about staying true to our mission, making sure that the work that we're doing is really good quality, never deviating from that.
In a sentence, what would you absolutely love if a business or businesses came to you with, besides like big plastic bags, loads of cash? What would you, you know, I can hear what you're saying, that you're trying to be all inclusive and loving and nurturing. And
I think just a really like important, like what we find works really well is when there's like an alignment between like, you know, an independent venue like us and a company that's like really also mission driven, you know, like, I know that like it's, you know, they're profit driven at the end of the day, but like, you know, that have a strong understanding of their own place in the community and the role that they serve, you know, and that could
mean... Have you met with Evelyn Moynihan of Kilkenny?
Not yet.
they are mission driven.
Yeah?
I think she's been on. You must listen back to that podcast.
I must listen to that one, yeah.
She might be a lady now who might be very, very interested in what you're talking about.
Yeah. I think it's the kind of a meeting of minds is really important, yeah. You know, and understanding the opportunity
I've
that comes
with just spent a couple
of
hundred thousand of her money for it with you.
You go now. Thank you very much.
Final question. Who would you, Eileen Gleeson, hire in a heartbeat?
I think that I would ask Paul Simon to come to Cork and work with our musicians in this country and our traditional music and our legacy and heritage to create a project that would emulate what he did with Graceland.
In South Africa.
Yeah.
What a lovely idea. Do you know him? Did you meet with him?
I don't know him.
I bet you Barack Obama.
Get on the
phone to Barack. Have you got Barack Obama's phone number?
Didn't quite get that far now, to be fair.
I bet you Mr. O would be...
I'm sure he'd have him on the line somewhere, yeah.
That's a lovely idea.
I mean, it's a dream. It's a dream, you know? Well, we have to dream.
I'm not saying anything, but better happen quickly, if you know what I mean.
I know.
Okay. Eileen Gleeson, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Dundeal Motors is home to Ireland's largest range of new and premium used cars. That's why you'll find cars from Audi and BMW dealerships on Dundeal. Are you looking for a 7-seater to accommodate your growing family? Maybe you're after a luxury saloon to make a statement. We have the car for you. You'll also find Ireland's largest range of electric cars to help you make the switch. Visit dundeal.ie today to start the search for your next car.
De Facto, the revolutionary shaving oil, changing the face of shaving. For the smoothest shave of your life, just add water. No more lathering up or cleaning up afterward. Just add a few drops of water and you're ready to go. De Facto's blend of all natural oils hydrates and protects your skin. No more razor burns or irritation. A spa treatment for your face. Perfect for all skin types and lasts so much longer than traditional foams or gels. De Facto, a shaving revolution. Just add water. Available from selected pharmacies and from defactoshave.com.
It's all go, let Chrissy know on thatgreatbusinessshow.com.
That Great Business Show.
And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 154. Great business insights and inspiration, all thanks to our sponsor, dundeal.ie. Go online and kick some tires at dundeal.ie and see what your next car could look like. Sign up for email updates and we'll send you your own personal copy of the podcast. The address is thatgreatbusinessshow.com. And that's where to go if you would like to advertise with us as well. We record at the Dublin South Podcast Studios, where sound engineer Mark McCarthy got top billing as our studio engineer. Second on the bill was Lee Brennan. Later, studio manager and post-production superstar Peter Rice will keep the divas in us happy with his soothing tweaks that ensure we remain the world's best-selling business podcast. If you would like to record your own podcast, Peter is the man to chat to. So from me, Conal O'Moran, buíochas to you all, agus slán tamach.